Support for the California Report comes from the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And Barracuda Networks, innovators of network security and data protection solutions designed to thwart cyber threats and data loss for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at barracuda.com/KQED.
Would you buy a less than perfect piece of fruit? This week on the California Report, how a few flaws can lead to food waste and global warming.
A lot of that fruit has good value. There's nothing wrong with it. Just got a little cosmetically challenged, like all of us, you know.
Plus, a state Supreme Court ruling exposes the fight over managing water rights. Tech innovators take on some of the state's worst health problems. And playwright Anna Deavere Smith's new work explores the school-to-prison pipeline.
It is a broader problem that is linked to poverty. And, you know, the question is, how do we help people be productive citizens to the country, to their families, to their communities?
I'm Susie Rocho, in for Scott Schaefer. This is the California Report. If you're listening to this, you've been studied. Research says that you're more likely to be a curious traveler and lifelong learner who cares about the environment. And about that, maybe you're letting your lawn go brown, driving less? Well, some experts say there's another way that you can be environmentally friendly, and it might be something that you heard from your parents. Stop wasting food. From the farm to the fridge, it's estimated that 40% of what could be eaten just isn't, and that can impact climate change. For the series California Foodways, Lisa Morehouse reports on a new partnership trying to change the way consumers think about less-than-perfect produce.
Pear season has just begun, and I'm in an orchard in the Sacramento Delta trying to stay out of the way of workers who are literally running from tree to tree with ladders, picking the biggest pears.
We have a lot of wind in the Delta, and that's why we grow very good fruit, because we have cool Delta breezes at night.
Chuck Baker manages this ranch. He says that helpful wind can also cause what's called limb rub. He points to a fat pear.
Right here. See these marks here? This is just from the wind swinging the pear a little bit against another pear or a limb, and it makes a mark. The industry in the past has set the standards very high where they don't allow those marks. A lot of that fruit has good value. There's nothing wrong with it, you know. Just got a little cosmetically challenged, like all of us, you know.
As workers dump loads of pears into bins on a tractor, produce broker Ron Clark laments these standards.
It's not just in our food, it's in our lives. You know, we have a lot of images that are sent to us of thin models and perfect-looking Hollywood faces, but that's not reality, is it?
Clark co-founded a new startup called Imperfect Produce, which is trying to change consumers' perceptions and find homes for cosmetically challenged produce. They're starting with low-cost CSA boxes and a grocery store partnership I'll tell you about in a minute. Clark takes me to a nearby packing shed where the fruit gets washed, then sorted by lines of women quickly separating imperfect pears from the marketable ones, which get hand-wrapped and packaged.
20% of fresh produce that's grown for the fresh market never makes it to human consumption.
That means it's not on grocery store shelves or in canned products or even juices.
It either gets plowed back into the field, composted, or ends up in landfill.
So what's the big deal?
We're basically aiding climate change from the food that we throw away.
That's Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland. He says huge amounts of water and energy are used on farms, in transportation, in refrigerators, and in stores. And wasted food dumped in landfills produces the greenhouse gas methane.
The two largest creators of waste are farms and households.
Enter Meg Burritt. She works out of the West Sacramento headquarters of the grocery store chain Raley's, which has over 100 stores in Northern California and Nevada.
There's a couple of problems that I think we as grocers haven't addressed in our history as an institution, and one of them is food waste.
Another, she says, is helping people on a budget access enough nutritious produce. She didn't know exactly what part Raley's could play until last fall when she saw a video produced by French grocer Intermarché.
Nous avons lancé les fruits et légumes moches pour célébrer la beauté.
The store specifically marketed ugly produce. The video went viral and they reported spectacular sales.
Et de la clémentine moche.
A similar program started in a huge Canadian chain.
I'm an optimist, so I thought, well, if they're doing it in France, they're doing it in Canada, we can definitely do it here in the States.
So Raley's partnered with Imperfect Produce, and last weekend, they launched a pilot program in 10 California stores. They targeted neighborhoods where customers may have tighter budgets or where there aren't a lot of shopping options. At the Auburn store, the display of what they're calling real good produce is a few feet from the door, with pears and bell peppers piled high. Regular customer Rich Purdom gravitates toward the bright red, elongated peppers.
So I go by color when I buy vegetables, you know.
So do you see this? These are being sold at below price because they're considered a little bit...
Oh, they're funny looking? Doesn't bother me. They're going to get chopped up in fajitas, so always up at the same spot, right?
These peppers cost about 75 cents each compared to $2 for a regular one. Kate Johnson's been shopping here 35 years and makes a beeline for the pears, which she's loading into a paper bag. She read about the program in the newspaper.
And they mentioned that they're going to use fruit that is maybe not what you would usually buy because it's a little bit smaller or blemished in some way. But we know it's perfectly all right.
I say to her, some people don't know that.
Well, they should be a little more informed.
The pilot program will last about 90 days, starting with pears, plums, and red and green peppers, then moving to other produce. If the Auburn store is any indication, it's going well so far. In the first week, they've sold way more imperfect produce than they thought they would. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Auburn.
As our historic drought continues, so do the fights over water. Earlier this year, the State Water Resources Control Board issued mandatory cutbacks for stakeholders, including for those who've held water rights for over 100 years. But a recent ruling by a Sacramento Superior Court judge raises questions about how the state regulates and manages these rights. KQED science reporter Lauren Summer is here to explain. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Well, before we get to the ruling, let's talk about water rights. I mean, who owns these and what do they allow folks to do?
Yeah, water rights are really the backbone of California's entire water system. And the easiest way to explain them is with donuts.
Oh, that sounds good.
Say you're at work, you know, there's an email that goes out, hey, free donuts in the break room. Well, instead of just grabbing one when you get there, you have to get in line with all the employees based on how long you've worked there. So people that have been there the longest, they get the first donuts. The newbies have to wait. Well, that's exactly how water works during a drought in California. The oldest water rights, you know, these are going back to the gold rush. And these are folks, some are landowners, some are water districts, some are irrigation districts. They get priority over water. And the folks with the newer claims have to wait and see how much water is left. And so that's what the state did earlier this year. They looked at the water situation, said, hey, there's not enough water. And they sent out letters for about 9,000 water rights saying you have to cease and desist using water because there's not enough.
Before we move on to the ruling, there are junior rights holders and senior rights holders. What's the difference?
Yeah, there's kind of this artificial line that was drawn. You know, people were claiming water way back to the gold rush, but the state didn't really create a state agency until around 1914. So everybody that had rights before then, they're kind of called senior rights, and everybody who got rights after that was kind of these junior water rights.
Okay, so Sacramento Superior Court Judge Shelley Ann Chang issued a temporary order last week that basically suspended curtailment from the state water board for four districts in the Central Valley. These were districts who were challenging the state's authority to basically order those cutbacks, right?
Yeah, and what the judge said is that the state can't send out these letters saying that people have to cease and desist using water because water is like a property right. Water rights are property rights. And the state can't take away your property rights without some sort of evidence and hearing or due process.
And so how has the state responded?
So what the state did is they essentially just reworded all these letters they sent out to water holders telling them to cease and desist, and they softened that language up and said, hey, we'd like it if you take it upon yourselves to stop pumping water because there's not enough. I'm not actually telling you to do that. But if we catch you through an inspection pumping water when you shouldn't be, we can actually enforce that. It's kind of like the speed limit signs on a freeway. You know, the law is the law. The speed limit is a speed limit. But a lot of people speed anyway, kind of risking that they're not going to get caught. And that's exactly what's kind of happening with water this year.
And has anybody gotten caught? I mean, what's going on with enforcement?
Yeah, so just this week, the state announced that they did catch one of these water districts. And this is one of the water districts involved in the lawsuit, the Westside Irrigation District near Tracy. They said that during an inspection, they found that they were taking water when they shouldn't be, and there'll be a hearing to kind of see if that's the case. The district could be fined up to $10,000 a day. Obviously, the water district thinks this is a retaliation for the lawsuit, but the state is saying, hey, we've got to show that there's cops on the beat that are kind of catching these speeders. Otherwise, what are we doing?
And what are the potential implications of this ruling? I mean, does it look like other water districts are going to use it to challenge the water board on their own curtailment issues?
Yeah, there were four other lawsuits in addition to this one. So there were a lot of folks that were unhappy with this. What the judge did say in this ruling was that the state does have power to kind of enforce these water rights, even if they had to kind of soften these letters, these speed limit signs that they sent out to people. And there's actually a lot of power that the state has in the state constitution. There's language in there that says the state can prevent the waste and unreasonable use of water in California. That's very broad language if the state really chooses to implement it. So they have a lot of power if they want it.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
Lauren Summer is a reporter with KQED Science. A group of tech entrepreneurs from Silicon Valley has taken on a huge task, trying to improve the overall health of an entire community in five places across the country in just 5 years. One of those targets is in rural Lake County, just north of Napa, which has the highest rates of diabetes, obesity, and domestic violence in the state. David Gorn traveled there to find out if these innovators, with all of their tech tools, can help the county turn those numbers around.
Lake County used to be such an idyllic place.
A pleasant scenic drive through the wine country. Enjoy tennis, golf, swimming, and water sports of all kinds.
There's Clear Lake itself, of course. That was a huge attraction. And there was the semi-famous Conocte Harbor Resort with all the hit bands from yesteryear. Today, though, the lake has so much mercury in it, it's a Superfund site. Conocte Harbor Resort closed 6 years ago. This remote paradise is now, well, just remote. If you follow the dirt path and walk behind Ray's supermarket, you reach a well-known secret site in Clear Lake, a homeless encampment with dozens of badly erected tents and lean-tos tucked among the shrubs and the web of trails. It's one of several encampments in the Clear Lake area. Chad Lindsay is 28 years old, newly homeless, only 6 months on the street. He says he usually stays away from other homeless people because he doesn't want to get used to it.
I can't stand to look at people's faces when they're so defeated. And it's like, how do you stay homeless for 6 years in the same town or even the same tent, the same spot? Can you imagine that?
Lindsay might find out how that happens, since Lake County is among the poorest counties in the state, and that fact is reflected in its abysmal health record.
Well, Lake County has a lot of challenges. It is somewhat isolated. It is a county whose economics are in hard times.
That's Marshall Kubota, medical director of a health plan that serves the county's low-income population. Statewide, Lake County ranks dead last in a number of health indicators. Extremely high rates of smoking, obesity, mental illness, domestic violence. And of course, Kubota says, they don't call it the meth capital of Northern California for nothing.
Methamphetamine was in Lake County before methamphetamine was what it is today.
That dubious claim to fame and those horrible healthcare numbers have caught the attention of one Silicon Valley philanthropist and a nonprofit project called The Way to Wellville. This training session in a tiny conference room in Upper Lake is the first step in a long process to narrow down the laundry list of bad health indicators to a few manageable targets.
The global payment scheme helps to supercharge.
Esther Dyson is a technology investor and founder of the Wellville Project.
We're not waltzing in here and saying you need to do the Silicon Valley thing.
They want this lake community to transform itself. Because Lake County is so small, she says, just a few locals here could make big changes.
Our premise doing this is that most health interventions are like peeing in the lake. You know, no visible outcome. So what we're trying to do is find a bathtub, a smaller community like Lake County, and do things at critical density.
Dyson's team works with 5 communities across the country, taking a Silicon Valley startup approach to fixing healthcare. That doesn't equate to cash. Right now, there is no money. But there is expert advice on how to solve problems. The 2 big questions are, will rural Lake County be suspicious and reluctant to follow advice from the button-down collars of Silicon Valley? And second, if they do follow that advice, will it work?
Okay, that was about 30 seconds, so finish up.
David Santos is CEO of St. Helena Hospital in Clear Lake, and he says he's fed up with anyone taking a wait-and-see approach. He's waited, he says. He's seen. He says most of the health professionals in Lake County know it's time to try something new.
To bring a team of leaders throughout the county together for one common cause was the single most significant thing that has happened in this county in a long, long time.
One big component is technology. IBM is already on board with its Watson Health artificial intelligence computer. Apple may soon follow with its iPhone or Apple Watch to self-monitor health and activity. Those tech devices may not work for everyone in Lake County, Dyson says, but they might work for some of them.
Lake County's not going to fix everything, but there's some place between perfection and where they are now that's a lot better.
And there's one other huge opportunity in the air, Dyson says, her connections with Silicon Valley investors.
If I can't get one or two of those Silicon Valley billionaires up here, I'll be very disappointed.
Whatever help comes from venture capital or tech innovations, the root of success for this project clearly rests on the health community in Lake County, that room full of people in that tiny conference room in Upper Lake. For the California Report, I'm David Gorn in Lake County.
David Gorn is senior reporter for California Healthline, a health policy news service. Schools are not always a welcoming place for some children of color. They're suspended, expelled, even arrested way out of proportion to their numbers in the student population, often setting them on a dangerous and unpredictable path to the criminal justice system. Some call this the school-to-prison pipeline. It's the focus of an unconventional play by Anna Deavere Smith, which she hopes will get people thinking about solving the problem. Cy Musiker explains.
Whenever I talk to young people in Stockton, I always quote the Tupac poem about the rose that grew from concrete, when he talks about long live the rose that grew from the crack in the concrete when no one else cares.
Actress and playwright Anna Deavere Smith is one of the characters in her new play, Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education, premiering this week at Berkeley Repertory Theater. Smith is best known for her TV work, most recently on Showtime's Nurse Jackie, but she's been making documentary theater about race, class, and social justice for decades. She interviews people who know the issues firsthand and then embodies a dozen or more on stage with quick changes in costume and voice.
For light young men of color in Stockton, it's almost this prevailing sense of nihilism.
Like Michael Tubbs, an African-American city councilman from Stockton.
You have a undercast of young people just feel forgotten, neglected, just angry, don't know what to be angry at.
Tubbs is one of almost 150 people Smith interviewed over the past 2 years for Notes. During a break from rehearsals, Smith says it's a show that's very personal.
I came from teachers. My mother was a teacher. All her friends were teachers.
In a poor Baltimore neighborhood. And Smith says these days teachers are taking an unfair share of the blame for funneling troubled students, mostly African-American and Latino, into the school-to-prison pipeline.
Because it is a broader problem that is linked to poverty. And, you know, the question is, how do we help people be productive citizens to the country, to their families, to their communities?
The monologues are underscored with musical backing from bassist, bandleader, and composer Marcus Shelby. Here, Shelby improvises on Spanish Harlem, A song, he says, that captures one of the show's themes, how teachers often struggle to help poor kids grow like a rose out of the sidewalk.
It's the dichotomy between tragedy and triumph, all of the ways that we feel life, anger, happiness, love, tension, release.
The play has a surprise built into its second act. At intermission, 20 facilitators, some from the writing corps Youth Speaks, break the audience up into groups of 30 or so for a brisk whiteboard exercise.
I'd like to welcome you all here and congratulate you all on being a part of a very different type of theater experience.
At a preview earlier this week, poet Dalek Brathwaite led one group, prompting them to imagine how changing the system would feel and sound.
First thing that came to mind for me of what it sounds like is no more gunshots.
No more gunshots.
I grew up in a gospel tradition.
All right.
You know, and during that time, you had excitement about what happened, you know, in the congregation. And they all came together as one.
Energizing a liberal, middle, and upper-class audience in Berkeley, maybe not so challenging. But it raises the question of whether theater or any art form can change society. Anna Deavere Smith bristled a bit when I asked the question. After all, she said spirituals help drive the civil rights movement.
Art is a form of expression that gets beyond the official language. It has the opportunity to really draw more people in and to draw them in a place of their heart, you know, where they might just make an adjustment about how they think about things.
Smith will be motivating people to change the school-to-prison pipeline through August 2nd at Berkeley Rep. Then she's negotiating to take the show to another city in California and three more on the East Coast. For the California Report, I'm Cy Musiker.
I hate to break it to you, but summer is half over. With the long days, it's a great time to take in a play or concert outside. But for a Santa Rosa theater group, performing outdoors is also about making their work accessible. The Imaginist Theater Troupe travels by bicycle, setting up in public parks and gardens throughout the city. And their plays, just like their audiences, are bilingual. KQED's Jessica Plotcheck went to check out their latest production.
A pack of bikes crosses a grassy field in Santa Rosa. They're loaded up with costumes, props, set pieces, and actors. The Imaginists have set up at a local park where golden light bathes sunflowers and rows of corn.
I dreamed that I was a flower hidden in the grass.
Why would you ever dream of that?
Y que las dulces gotas de rocío eran labios que me cubrían.
Today they're putting on a bilingual version of The Butterfly's Evil Spell, or El Maleficio de la Mariposa. It's an early work by Spanish poet and playwright Federico García Lorca. The play is about an insect wedding.
I don't know what love is. Yo no sé qué es el amor.
The troupe performs on grass under a huge, tense metal skeleton. The audience sits just outside it on tree stumps and blankets. The stage is set up like a banquet with colorful paper flowers and a piñata. Performers are costumed in tuxes and magenta gowns with antennae.
Vuela. Vuela. I want to fly away from here.
It's an odd choice for a play. Lorca himself wasn't very proud of it. The piece doesn't even have a proper ending. But the Imaginists and the crowd love it. They even shout at the stage, urging the couple to kiss.
It's awesome that they bring the theater to the people, you know, so there's no longer that threshold of having to pay.
That's Karim Sanchez. He's part of the diverse audience that includes young and old, white and Latino. Actor Sergio Zavala discovered the Imaginists at a day laborer center.
It's an important thing because the majority of us Latinos came here to work. We don't have time to go to the theater. So the people we perform for have really liked it.
Some actors are bilingual, others just speak Spanish or English. but everyone delivers lines in both languages.
Communication can happen in a lot of different ways rather than just language, so that's an interesting component.
Amy Pinto co-founded the Imaginists. She says they also want to make theater unintimidating, so they use untrained community actors, bicycles, and a lot of humor. In The Butterfly's Evil Spell, actors sing, rap, dance, and employ slapstick comedy.
The way that you introduce people to that environment is, of course, opening up and to become vulnerable with us. And laughter, of course, is a perfect opportunity to open people up.
Brent Lindsay co-founded the Imaginists. He says they also bring audiences in by inviting some of the kids on stage, even asking them to create their own ending for the play.
Ideas for the end.
Ideas para el final?
He says not everyone in Santa Rosa understands their approach. They've been producing bilingual plays for 6 years, but they haven't gotten a lot of local press. It's also taken a while to be accepted by the art scene here.
It was difficult to convince people that what you were doing was anything but amateur. Convincing people that the ideas were coming from the right place, you know, that took years and years.
After the show, audience members Evan Wigg and Enedina Vera are energized.
Oh my God, it was incredible. I feel alive, I feel inspired. It's a beautiful spot in a beautiful part of this county. And I was just absolutely blown away by the performances.
I really enjoyed seeing the kids enjoying the play and relating to it. So, you know, some of the things were very particular to the cultura. Just seeing their faces smile and react to the different parts of the play, which are very colorful.
You can catch the next show this Sunday in Santa Rosa's Humboldt Park. For the California Report, I'm Jessica Placzek.
Hello, I'm Gary Beiser, and I'm the lead coordinator at Precita Center for the Youth. The youth we have here today range from K through second grade. They are all residents of the Mission District here in San Francisco.
That's the California Report, the production of KQED, Public Radio, in San Francisco.
The director is Nina Thorson.
Our technical producer is Seal Muller.
We had additional engineering from Howard Gellman, Dan Bringer, Tim Bennett, and Rob Space.
The online team include David Marks, David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, and Olivia Allen Price.
Our interns are Laura Kleinman and Natalia Estrada.
California Reports, editorial team, Cute,
Victoria Maino, Ingrid Becker, Andrea Kisick, Taki Hendrix, and Cody Kernan.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.
California Foodways is made possible with support from Cal Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Visit www.calhum.org. Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. More at irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of children at risk in California.